Matthew chapter 2, verse 1 to 12. Now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose, and have come to worship him. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. They told him, In Bethlehem of Judea, for so it is written by the prophet, And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, Go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word, that I too may come and worship him. After listening to the king, they went on their way, and behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. Then opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way.
Thanks, Claudius. You truly know you're amongst friends when they start to ridicule when they see you. One day you'll get old too, Michelle. The essence of true Christianity is knowing God. That's what Christmas is all about, isn't it? Not just eating and drinking, giving and receiving gifts, as good as those things might be, but God coming to man that they might know him. And in this process of God coming to men and women, boys and girls, the ways he uses are sometimes as remarkable as they are manifold. In some cases, his revealing himself to the heart of a person can be almost without so much as a hint of drama. And there a child is born into a Christian home, a godly home, and raised by godly parents, and in that environment they're nurtured, so that following the ways of their parents is just something that seems perfectly natural to them. And somehow, virtually imperceptibly in that environment, the child has become a believer. There's no apparent moment of crisis. And if you were to ask that child in years later, having grown up and still walking consistently, they may say something like they can't even remember a time when they weren't a Christian. And then there are instances when God, over an extended period of time, seems to gradually draw near to people. And over that period of time, God in different ways and through varying circumstances seems at times, as it were, to be near to them, more real to them. Maybe through times of devastating disappointment, or through ill health, serious sickness, or some other life-changing incident. Or maybe through the death of a dear loved one. Times when the things that seemed so important to their happiness are put into perspective in view of the things that really are important. And at some point in crisis, in that person's life, they begin to realize and see their greatest need, God himself. And from that point, their life is changed forever. And there are, of course, those instances of God saving those who seem to be beyond hope. In the very grip of Satan. Slaves to alcohol or drugs or sex, without natural affection, without light, living enslaved to their urges and without moral constraint. And so when they come to faith, it truly is a crisis moment a bit like light against blackness. But however a person speaks about their having come to know God, the litmus test of a true encounter with God, or if you like, of what true Christianity is that the result is always one that brings them to know and worship God through Jesus Christ, his Son. And so insofar as the means God uses to bring people to himself, maybe from the mundane as reading the Bible, or to the unsettling of spirit through perhaps strange and troubling dreams, or through dramatic and painful providences, no matter how simple or how sensational that process may have been, the acid test of true Christianity is, did that experience produce a life lived in worship of God through Jesus Christ, his Son? Because if it didn't, then that experience was due to something other than a true encounter with God, however sensational it may have been. On our passage before us this morning, in this familiar Christmas story, we have three examples of people encountering God and their responses to him. And the first example I want to put before you is the example of King Herod and what I've called a deluded response. And what we're told in this account is that during the reign of King Herod, some unusual people from another part of the world entered into his jurisdiction, not to seek him, but rather to seek another king, one who they described as having been born king of the Jews, verse 2. How he heard that these men had arrived and how they began to make the inquiries, we're not told in the passage. What we are told, though, is that when Herod heard about them, verse 3, that he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Now, this troubling that King Herod felt was something deep down. And we could just as easily translate the word troubled by saying that he was disturbed, or he was frightened, or he was stirred up or agitated. He was deep down in his spirit made deeply anxious. And the people of Jerusalem, knowing Herod to be the kind of king that he was, also became disturbed. Because everyone in Judea knew it was always in the best interests of everyone to have a happy Herod. Because a happy Herod meant peace in the land, whilst a troubled Herod could mean virtually anything. You see, Herod was a piece of work, as we might describe in contemporary terms. Piece of work not like Shakespeare's Hamlet, where he described man with his abilities as a piece of work in a noble way. But how that term piece of work has come to imply in our day, Herod was a nasty piece of work. See, Herod wasn't a Jew, not by birth. He was an Edomite. He was the son of an Idumean, Antipater. And he was made king of Judea by the Romans in 40 BC. And in that time, up until the birth of Christ, he not only crushed all opposition, governed with an iron fist, engaged in building works, including the recommencing of the building of the temple in Jerusalem in 20 BC. But also in that time, he'd imposed heavy taxes on the people. And he'd become deeply resentful of the Jews who saw him as a usurper in his position. And he displayed all the characteristics of a megalomaniac. He's one who became increasingly known for his uncontrollable fits of rage. And one who had become so paranoid about his throne that he even murdered his favorite wife and two of his own sons when he suspected that they were scheming against him. So when this nasty piece of work heard that certain distinguished men following celestial signs from another country were in town looking for one born of the King of the Jews, Herod's paranoia kicked into high gear as he once again feared a threat to his throne. And so when Herod became troubled, all Judea also became troubled. So in his paranoia, we learn that Herod, in verse 4, assembled all the chief priests and scribes of the people, and that he inquired of them where the Christ, this rival king, was to be born. Then in verse 7, he summoned the wise men themselves secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared, so as to try to pinpoint the exact time this king of the Jews was born and how old he was by then. Then in verse 8, he sent these men to Bethlehem on advice from the religious leaders that this little town in Judea would be where this king would be born. And he encouraged them to search diligently for him with the lie that he also wanted to worship this king when he was found. Now we know that was a lie because when we fast forward the story a little bit, we learn that when Herod realized that he'd been tricked by the wise men, verse 16, that he was furious. And in another act of rage, driven by his paranoia, he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem and all in that region who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he'd ascertained from the wise men. So here's the first response in our Christmas passage of a man who in an indirect way engaged with God. It's the response of a madman, a deluded man, a man who has one driving motive in life, to rule and to reign, and a man who used everything at his disposal, power, wealth, position, influence, all of which he had in abundance, to rule over Judea without peer. That's what the man was like. But it begs the question, doesn't it? What so drives a person so that contentment with life isn't enough? That having enough isn't enough? And what so drives a person to be numero uno, such that his reason became affected and his feelings and emotions became perverted, even to the point of murdering his own loved ones? And what drives a person to such a fit of unbridled rage that he senselessly slaughters countless innocent babies to achieve his aim? And while it's been suggested that Herod in later years was inflicted with an illness that compounded his paranoia, that's not the root of his problem. See, the root of Herod's problem was his own sinful heart. The sinful heart which wanted to be without peer. The man who must have it his way. A man in control. A king. You've probably met that kind of person. They say things like, it's either my way or the highway. That's what Herod was like. And when Herod couldn't have things his way, his pent-up anger would explode in fits of rage, sometimes with staggering consequences. And so deeply troubled with the thought of this rival king, one born from amongst the Jews and likely to be received by them where he hadn't been, he schemed to remove him. And when he realized he'd been outwitted by the wise men who had departed to their own country by another way and that his plan had failed, without restraint and driven by his paranoia, so he took vengeance out in plan B. Murder them all. Every male Jewish boy, 2 years old and under, destroy them so I can remain. And the glaring irony of King Herod is that though he wanted to rule everything, he couldn't even rule his own sinful heart. Deluded by sin, the desire to be number one, confronted by the one who alone is King of Kings, and who was now born to establish his never-ending kingdom, and who alone would be a king without peer, without rival, Herod did all he could to obliterate him. It's the response of a deluded madman, driven by his own lusts and fears. Lust to have his own way, no matter what the cost, and fear to lose himself, lose what he has in case he loses himself. Do you know, Herod's response is in fact the deluded response of everyone who rejects King Jesus and all who are naturally ruled by their own sinful hearts. And that's because deeply embedded in each and every one of us is not only the desire to be in control, to be free, to be able to do whatever we want to do, but also deeply etched into each and every one of us is a resistance to being told what to do. And you can prove that, can't you, very easily in just observing a little child. You tell a little child, don't touch that or don't do that. What happens? They immediately turn to do what you told them not to do. It's the response of a sinless heart, a sinful heart, that lusts to have its own way and fears to lose what it has. And from the extreme case of Herod to the seemingly innocent heart of a little child, the same problem exists in every one of us, a sinful heart. But no more is that so evident than when a person is confronted with the claims of Jesus Christ on their heart, but they reject him. When they reject the only solution to their problems because of their lust to be kings of their own lives and because of their fear to lose themselves to God. That is the response of a deluded heart. But you know, frighteningly, Herod actually is very much like all of us. Because in the last analysis, we all suffer from the same disease. Not paranoia, but the disease of a sinful heart that lusts to have self on the throne of our lives. And we often betray ourselves when self can't have what self wants. And we throw up our little tantrums. And we betray ourselves whenever we capitulate to sin against the Lord, to temporarily put away the rival king from the throne in our hearts. Now, we may not be without constraint, and we may not be certifiably insane, but what form of sanity trades peace and confidence and love in God for a moment of self-indulged pleasure that's followed by perhaps days, in some cases even a lifetime, of misery and guilt? What form of sanity trades the preciousness of a loved one's gaze for the stench of guilt and death and putrefaction? Only the delusion of our sinful hearts, which lusts to have its own way no matter what, and which fears to lose what it has, lest we lose ourselves. How we all need King Jesus to reign without peer on the throne of our hearts. And how we all need the light of his word and the power and presence of his Holy Spirit to constrain us to him. Because you see, that's what a relationship with God alone can only do. And that's what anything other than a relationship with God can never do. And the litmus test of any true encounter with God must produce this end: love for God that desires his presence and so learns to hate the sins that he hates and a love for God that dies daily to self in habitual worship of Him. Is that your experience today? No matter how poor it may seem to you sometimes, that is what drives you and motivates you, love for God. Because if it's not, then it must be said that you failed the litmus test. Now, the second response to an encounter with Jesus in our passage is the response of the religious man, in which I've termed the response of head and not heart. In verse 4, we're told, in his attempt to locate this rival king, that Herod assembled all the chief priests and scribes of the people, and that he inquired of them where Christ was to be born, the king was to be born. And with brilliant biblical accuracy, they told him, verse 5, Bethlehem of Judea. And they base their deduction on the prophecy on Micah chapter 5 and verse 2. But now here's the interesting bit. The original text of Micah 5:2 reads like this: But you, O Bethlehem Ephrathah, you who are too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me one who is to be the ruler in Israel, whose coming forth is from of old, from ancient days. That's the complete quote. But Matthew in his gospel deliberately took that text and modified it, and then added some words from 2 Samuel chapter 5 and verse 2. So it reads like this in verse 6. And you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. You see, it's quite different. And the reason Matthew altered and conflated these Old Testament passages was not only to confirm this messianic ruler's birthplace by Micah, as the religious leaders had also understood and so advised Herod, but also to highlight the connection between Israel's King David and David's greater son, Jesus, something that Matthew's been hinting at from the very first verse of the Gospel. And by reflecting on 2 Samuel 5, which speaks of David's inauguration as king over Israel with its prophetic and its shepherding overtones, and conflating it with Micah chapter 5, a prophecy concerning the Messiah, ruler who would be born in Bethlehem of Judah, Matthew intended that the reader would see this connection between the Christ King, descended from the line of David, and who, like David himself, was Israel's shepherd king, also born in Bethlehem. It's as if Matthew is, in conflating these texts, in line with his kingdom theology, his kingdom emphasis in the gospel, wanted his readers to see this. King David, Jesus-born king, shepherd king of Israel connection, and to see that Jesus born in Bethlehem was indeed David's greater son and deliverer, as foretold by Micah, as well as the other prophets in the Old Testament. I mention that in part to explain why Matthew wrote and quoted as he did. But I also mention that because some people see such instances of differing expressions of particularly Old Testament prophecy quoted in the New Testament, and they say that the New Testament writer was in error, that he misquoted the Old Testament, so that the Bible really isn't inspired by God because it's full of human errors. But if we understand that Matthew in his gospel account was not only inspired by the Holy Spirit in what he wrote, but also inspired by the Holy Spirit in the methodology he used in constructing his kingdom theme, then his changes and additions to the text of Micah make absolute and complete sense. And the charge of error becomes completely groundless. But irrespective of what Matthew intended and what motivated his recording of the events as he did, what's clear is that these religious leaders, the chief priests and scribes, clearly understood from the prophecy of Micah that Christ would be born in Bethlehem. But the staggering thing about these religious men is that having studied these things in the scriptures and having understood the prophet Micah and the birthplace of Christ, and then having heard the report from Herod of these wise men who had followed a star coming to see one who they called the King of the Jews, is that having seen and heard these things, they did absolutely nothing. At very least, you think they would have accompanied these men to their destination to either merely confirm or to rule out what they'd been saying. Now, these wise men had come by foot, some 1,300 kilometers, probably from Babylonia or today's Iraq, a distance about the length of the Nullarbor Plain, by foot. And the distance between Jerusalem, where the religious leaders were, and Bethlehem, where Christ was born, is a mere 9 kilometers. It's just down the road. I suppose the distance from probably here to Joondalup. And yet these Jewish chief priests and scribes who studied the Old Testament and supposedly waited their Messiah did nothing. Why? And the only answer I can think of is that unlike Herod, who couldn't be satisfied with anything less than total control, these religious leaders were satisfied with an empty religion of words. A religion that quibbled over details of Sabbath day duties, dietary regulations, matters of clean and unclean foods, purification laws, and whatever the other minutiae of the law they could find to argue about. And they were satisfied with that. And another amazing thing is that these religious leaders weren't the only ones in the time of Jesus and the apostles who were just like that. And it seems that this had spread to something like pandemic proportions. That's why Paul had to tell the Jews in the Church of Rome, didn't he, that it wasn't merely just being custodians of the law that mattered, it was the keeping of the law that mattered. Being mere custodians meant zero, nothing. That's why James rebuked his hearers for being merely hearers of the word. As if just to hear the word of God is what made you spiritual. No, he says, true religion is one that produces holy lives and hearts that know and love and worship God. Not merely intellectually religious brains. That's why later in this gospel, Jesus rebukes these very teachers saying, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faithfulness. These you ought to have done without neglecting the others. You blind guides, straining out a gnat to swallow a camel. You see, that's why any true encounter with Jesus will never merely produce barren scholarship, or perfect Presbyterians, or brilliant Baptists, or whatever pertains to religious culture, but rather lives indwelt and empowered by the Holy Spirit. And people who want to know and want to love and want to worship God through His Son, Jesus Christ, who was born in Bethlehem and who died to save them from their sins. Why? That they might know Him. The essence of true Christianity. Let me ask you again then, how is it with us this morning? Are we living such lives? Or are we merely content with a head religion? A dotting of the I's and a crossing of the T's? Have we come here today to worship King Jesus? Because His Spirit indwells us and motivates us to come and worship Him who was born and who died for us. Is that what motivates us this morning? Because of all people, if we've been healed of our deluded thinking And if we've been made new creatures, renewed hearts and minds, then there ought to be this deep desire to worship God who has done all of that for us. Oughtn't they? It's the litmus test of true Christianity, to want to know and to worship God. The third response we find in our passage of encounter with God is the response of the wise men, and what I've termed the response of true worshippers. Now, these wise men are very interesting people, though it's really quite uncertain as to who they actually were. Something like these are alluded to in the book of Daniel, chapter 2, where it speaks of magicians and enchanters and sorcerers and astrologers in some translations. And where the word magoi, the plural of magi, is used in the Septuagint translation of the Hebrew into the Greek. It's incidentally where the word magi comes from, where some translators translate wise men. It's where the word, our English word magic, comes from. So there's this connection with these people. But then there's another connection. There's a connection with these men and a priestly caste of Medes, who it seems were able to interpret dreams. And again, that's reflected in Daniel 2. Under Nebuchadnezzar's dreams, when he was troubled, he called these wise men to come and interpret them. And later on, tradition also linked these wise men with kingly status. So you get this picture why these men were referred to as wise men, men of unusual, dignified status, and who engage in rather dark areas. In our passage, we're simply told that these men came from the east. That's it. Now, it's been suggested, and I think there's more than a modicum of truth to it, that these men actually came from the ancient city of Babylon. And that decades earlier, during the time of the Babylonian exile, that the influence of Daniel in that city carried over in time to the time when these wise men existed. And it was that motivated what they did. Because being inquiring men, taking up with foreseeing future events, it may well be that they had become familiar with the Old Testament prophecy of Numbers 24 because of Daniel's influence and the Jewish influence. And Daniel 24 and verse 17 reads, "A star will come out of Jacob, a scepter or ruler will rise out of Israel." And then think of the impact of Daniel and his prophecies concerning the Messiah and how they would have filtered down through the ages. And that together with the general Jewish influence of that city. So maybe these men had become something like proselytes through the influence of Numbers and Daniel and the Jewish community. And that together with their interest in astrology and their searching the constellation for their signs, this is what motivated them to this point to follow a star. But whatever it was, they became compelled to follow a star, which they believed would take them to one born king of the Jews. There's been various attempts to explain this star. Come from the aligning of Jupiter and Saturn in the zodiac constellation in Pisces, 7 BC, and which I understand was just reoccurred on the 17th of this month, to a supernova, a distant star that violently exploded and emanated huge amounts of light for about a month or so, to Halley's Comet doing the rounds in 12 BC, as well as other suggestions. But all of these theories have serious problems. And it's probably best for us to say that the star that the wise men followed was but an unusual event that God had determined for his own purposes, and leave it at that. However that was. And remember, at the end of the day, the star isn't the focus of this account. It's remarkable. It's mysterious. It's almost certainly miraculous. But it's not the focal point. The star is but the sign and the guide that leads to Jesus, who is the focal point of this account. And that's something worth thinking about. Because as I mentioned earlier, the true Christianity, a true encounter with the living God, is essentially when God comes to man. That's always the way it is. It's always God taking the prerogative to bring people to himself through his Son, Jesus Christ. Never the other way around. And just as Christmas is about God sending his Son for sinners, and just as God provided a star for the wise men to lead them to Jesus, so too every time a person is saved, it's because God first drew them. But the point of what I'm saying is that as God is the sovereign Lord who chooses and draws sinners to his Son, so is he the sovereign Lord who uses whatever means he determines right and necessary in drawing people to his Son. But at the end of the day, those means he employs, be it a star that led wise men over thousands of kilometers to Bethlehem, or be it sickness or death, someone's testimony, the preaching of the word, whatever. All that means is that these are but means and means only. Their purpose and their place is to bring you to his Son who was born into the world and who died on the cross in order to save. Then wonderfully, when God does reveal Jesus to a person, when a person comes to engage in that predetermined encounter, whatever means were used to bring him there, the outcome is always the same. In the account of the star that led to Bethlehem and to the house where Joseph and Mary and Jesus were, notice here it's a house and not a stable. The child Jesus was probably about 2 years old by now. And when these wise men saw the child with his mother, they did two things. Or if you like, they responded in two ways. Verse 11, firstly, they bowed down and worshipped him, the Christ child. Notice that, they worshipped him, not them. And then same verse, they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and incense and myrrh. And what these wise men did is what happens every time a person is brought to a personal encounter with Jesus. They worship him and they offer the best of what they have to him. And that's why the litmus test of a personal saving encounter with God isn't substantiated on some sensational event that you or I might have experienced in the past. But it's substantiated on the response of a life of worship to the personal God through Jesus Christ in obedience and love to him. And that's the true essence of Christmas and of Christianity, isn't it? God coming to sinners through Jesus Christ, his Son, and sinners falling down in worship before him and offering to him the very best, their very lives for him and to him. Let me ask again this morning, have you done that? Have you had this personal encounter with Jesus that has since changed your life forever? Do you know that? Have you come to him? May it be that for someone here this Christmas, there may be a time that personal predetermined encounter with Jesus that will produce a life worship for God for the rest of your days. Maybe it'll be the same for those who perhaps decades ago came to Jesus in a personal encounter. May it be a reminder for us to worship and to bring the best of what we have for all the days that he gives us.